Welcome to another episode of The Wheat Prophet, a podcast where we explore all things wheat. The goal of this podcast is to provide Saskatchewan wheat producers with resources and information to increase profitability and sustainability on their farm. I will be interviewing experts in the field about current production issues and the latest wheat research. I'm your host, Haley Tatro, the Agronomy Extension Specialist with the Saskatchewan Wheat Development Commission. Seeding 2021 is starting to ramp up, and the conditions across many parts of the province are drier than normal. Seeding into dry soils can be inevitable on the prairies, and there are some challenges associated with that. Dry conditions require careful consideration of many management practices, such as seeding depth, seed treatment, seed safety, fertility, and herbicide carryover. Prairie Wheat and Barley Commissions teamed up to produce a resource for producers covering some important considerations for seeding into dry soils. This resource can be found on our website under the Agronomy tab. The less than average precipitation across many areas of Saskatchewan means that some herbicides may not have broken down and could potentially put this year's wheat crop at risk for herbicide damage. This is what we will be discussing on today's Wheat Prophet with our guest, Doug Fair. Doug worked in the ag industry for many years. He started with Monsanto in the early 80s and then took a position in North Battleford with DuPont, which later became Corteva. Doug worked as a technical sales agronomist until 2019 when he retired and now remains active in the industry doing contract agrology work. Doug, welcome to the Wheat Prophet and thank you for taking the time to be here with us today.
You're quite welcome, Haley.
So with much of Saskatchewan being very dry as we roll into seeding, herbicide carryover is a real concern this season. Many producers will remember the herbicide carryover issues that came up in the early 2000s, and we're seeing these dry conditions again, which I think makes this a pretty timely topic. So before we jump into the specifics, let's do a bit of an overview about what herbicide carryover is and how herbicides are broken down in the soil.
Sure. Well, the herbicide carryover, of course, would be, let's say, unexpected injury or damage to a rotational crop. Herbicides all have guidelines as to when you can seed rotational crops, and the ones that are sensitive, of course, there are specific guidelines. When we have the conditions that you mentioned, and there are possibly some other types of conditions, then sometimes we see unexpected carryover damage. What really occurs, there's really two let's say processes around breakdown. One I'll call short term, one I'll call medium to long term. The short term really isn't an issue for carryover concerns. In the short term, herbicides will break down by either volatilization, in other words gassing off, or by photo decomposition, and that's pretty much related to the pre-emergent products such as trifluralin and trilate, which is why they need to be incorporated or applied in a minimum tillage situation. When it comes to rotational crop concerns, in other words, medium or long-term breakdown, a lot of our herbicides are broken down through microbial activity. Some of them break down through hydrolysis, which is a chemical reaction. There are a few, not very many, that break down through percolation or dilution through the rooting zone. But the main two methods are microbial and hydrolysis, and both of those methods are really heavily influenced by moisture and by temperature.
So with the lack of moisture, I guess majority of our province, we've seen the moisture maps that we talked a little bit about on one of our previous podcasts, but that puts us at a high risk situation, I guess, in a lot of areas. But are there other factors, I guess, other than moisture that would cause that risk to be even higher?
Yeah, there can be, certainly. Moisture, too little, which we're dealing with in a lot of areas, or actually sometimes too much, can cause issues in terms of reduced breakdown. The too much obviously are more likely potholes and things like that. And that applies more, I'll suggest, to the pre-emergent herbicides again. But other influences can be organic matter. So if you've got very low organic matter, you tend to have poorer water holding ability. You tend to have less microbial activity, and you tend to have less binding or buffering of the herbicides that have been applied. If you've got lower clay content, again, you've got less binding of those herbicides, and they might be more available to sensitive rotational crops. For certain specific products, and these apply mainly to group 2 products or residual group 2 products, and to some group 14 and 15, soil pH will be a factor. So if the pH is, let's say, 1.0 pH units above or below, depending upon the herbicide, a pH of 7, which is considered neutral, that's where you start to potentially run into additional carryover conditions. So any of those factors combined with the lack of moisture can set up for a much greater risk of carryover injury.
So while we're talking about moisture, what is that break-even point, I guess you could call it, where, you know, it's possibly enough moisture to cause that herbicide to not have residual issues? Is there a magic number there?
Yeah, yes and no. There really isn't a magic number, because it's influenced by quantity, of course, which is the most obvious one, but it's also influenced by the time in which it occurs. In other words, a whole bunch of moisture the first week of May is of not a large amount of value. And I'd say a whole bunch of moisture end of September is of even lesser value. And the reason for that is in those timeframes, let's say the timeframes outside of the 1st of June and the middle of September, your soil temperatures are quite a bit cooler. And as a result, your microbial activity is slower. Your hydrolysis chemical reaction is slower. So there's less value in rainfalls outside of that period. And that's why when you see the map that the province puts out that you referenced a little bit earlier, they do develop that map based on rainfall, more so in the true growing period.
Okay. So which herbicides or herbicide groups do we typically see causing these herbicide injury issues? And more specifically, which ones do we tend to see issues with in wheat?
Yeah, so the group twos are ones that can have carryover issues, because there are residual and there are non-residual herbicides within group two. Group one generally are not an issue. Group nine being glyphosate, of course, not an issue. There are, and I'm trying to recall the group that the product Infinity is in, but that one can be an issue, not for wheat though.
27, I believe, right?
Yes, that's right, group 27. Some of the older chemistries, trifluralin in group 3, can be an issue specifically for wheat. So if we deal specifically for wheat, again, trifluralin can be a bit of an issue on low organic matter soils, drought conditions, that type of thing. The most common, though, probably on spring wheat and durum, are going to be the group 2 products, and specifically the subgroup imidazolinone, or IMI for short. So those are products that have the actives such as imazethapyr, which is Pursuit, or imazapyr, which is in Aries. Imazethapyr is also in Odyssey, by the way. A lot less risk with imazamox, which is Solo. Mm-hmm. So those are the herbicides that are probably the most of concern for carryover injury into spring wheat or durum.
And so what should producers be looking for if they suspect, you know, this is more in season, but if they suspect that they have an injury, how do these group two injuries kind of present themselves, I guess, in the growing season?
Yeah, great question. And it's sometimes a little bit difficult to diagnose. What I'm going to suggest, first of all, is that producers, agronomists, whoever's checking a field of concern, really carefully evaluate all factors. You'll want to include environmental factors, fertility factors, soil factors like potential salinity as an example. You'll want to look for patterns in the field, want to look for location in the field. Where are the symptoms showing up on the plant? Because that can often help with the diagnosis. What time did the symptoms appear? That can help quite a bit with diagnosis. You'll want to accurately describe to an agronomist what those symptoms look like. Don't forget to include the roots. A lot of people tend to forget to look at the roots, and those can lead to a very strong diagnosis. I've seen a lot of photos over the years, some of them quite good, a lot of them not very good. So do your best to take some very good quality photos, again, including the roots and as close up as possible. I will note that durum is typically more sensitive than spring wheat. So if you're seeing symptoms on both durum and spring wheat, but the durum appears worse, that might lead more towards a herbicide carryover issue than something else. In terms of specific symptoms, the plant's just going to look, you know, a lot less healthy or thrifty. It might be a little bit shorter. Very often you're going to see shortened internodes. So the distance between each of the leaves would be shorter than you typically would expect. The leaves themselves will be thinner than an untreated or a normal healthy crop. Root mass will be reduced. Now, if it's in the case of a group 3 trifluralin product, there's very, very classic symptoms with those. And that is really short, stubby, bunchy type of roots. Really, the stubby roots are very classic for trifluralin carryover. But with the group 2s, it's a little bit more difficult. And you might also see some striping on the leaves. I don't see that all the time, but sometimes you'll see striping that runs vertically up the leaf. And sometimes you'll see reduced tillering. Sometimes you'll see excessive tillering. The excessive tillering coming from the main leaf being kind of shut down and the plant trying to reinitiate new shoots, let's say, and sometimes you'll get excessive tillering that way. So I don't use the tillering as a real key indicator, reduced tillering in particular, but if it's excessive tillering, I think that's a fairly strong indicator as well of a group 2 issue.
So you mentioned previously, you mentioned a little bit about patterns. So I'm assuming, I guess if you had any areas with overlap, that would likely be, and you know you had overlap in those areas, that's probably where the symptoms would show up first, correct?
Yeah, we used to, in the old days, which I guess I'll class myself as, when before we had GPS, there was often lots of overlaps, and that made it very, very easy to see. But now with the new nozzle technology, GPS, et cetera, we don't see overlaps as often, but we still do see them. Headlands around power poles, corners around sloughs, those can be areas to look for. That is one pattern to consider. Another pattern might be chaff rows or straw rows. And so you can often pace out the space between the patterns. And sometimes you'll find that pattern, if it's running up the direction of travel up the field, sometimes that pattern will correspond in width to a chaff row. Sometimes it might correspond to a sprayer width. So there are, you know, many different types of patterns that can show up. And it's important, I would suggest, to examine those and try and determine where those patterns are coming from, or use those patterns to rule out other potential issues.
So being that we've had multiple drier than normal years, in many areas, is there potential for residuals to build up over time? Herbicide stacking, I guess, would be the term. Do you want to talk a little bit about what herbicide stacking is and when you could potentially see it?
Yeah, so the best definition I've seen for herbicide stacking came from Eric Johnson a number of years ago when Eric was at Agriculture Canada at Scott. The definition that he was using was the repeated application of different residual herbicides, which results in additive or synergistic injury to rotational crops. So think of it as a 1+1=2. Herbicide 1 plus herbicide 1 the following year gives you a 2 effect versus just a 1 effect that you'd expect. Or perhaps 1+1=3, where both are working together and causing much more than anticipated damage. Going into this year, in those drier areas, which again are indicated on the map, There is risk, I would suggest, for stacking, but in particular where there are other factors beyond just drought that would cause a product to carry over more than normal. So again, back to lower organic matter, very coarse textured or sandy soils, soils that are low in clay content, again, reduced binding, reduced water holding capacity, or for some of the products that are influenced by pH breakdown, so this would include some of the group two products, excessively, in the case of the IMIs, excessively low pH, where the IMIs will break down quite a bit more slowly. That's a very limited issue, I would suggest. The low pH areas are pretty much limited. Low pH to the extent that it would impact the IMI products are pretty much limited to northwestern or parts of northwestern Saskatchewan and into east central Alberta. Stacking is a possibility, especially those people that have dealt with drought for 2 years in a row.
Okay. So the other thing, I kind of actually just wanted to go back to this. When does when do they usually show up with group two injury? Because I've seen it before where, you know, the crop looks fine and then all of a sudden halfway through the growing season, you see issues. So can you maybe comment a little bit about that?
Yeah, great question. And I would suggest probably in that 2-3 leaf stage is where you're going to start to see things. Primarily because the roots are starting to develop quite well, and then the roots are starting to pick up those possible residues. So I would say the 2-3 leaf stage, I'd be surprised if you've not seen it by the 4 leaf stage. Or if you see it after the 4 leaf stage, I would say I'd be surprised by that. If you're seeing it for the first time after the 4 leaf stage, you probably haven't checked the field early enough, put it that way.
And so we talked a lot about different soil types, I guess, lower organic matter, sandier soils. So then if you're a farmer and you know that you have, you know, say a sandier ridge in your field, and that's kind of only, I guess this goes back to the whole patterns thing. And that's where you start to see it. I guess that would be a good indication as well that you're having herbicide issues. If you know that, you know, say these sandier areas, like why is this happening here? That could possibly be a factor.
Absolutely. Sandy eroded knolls, low areas that are maybe a little higher in fertility and better in moisture, you know, looking or showing absence of symptoms. I've seen situations with carryover where a pipeline's been run through a field. And of course, the soil's been disturbed and not in its natural state. And it's changed the chemical composition. In this specific example, it had changed the pH. In that line. So there's clues like that that you need to try and sort through. There can be so many differences going on in the field, and so often it's more than just one factor at a time.
So I guess most of these products in wheat then that are causing issues are coming off of pulse. So if we're putting wheat into pulse ground, it's pretty safe to say that that would be a little bit higher risk, correct?
Yeah, I would say given the amount of use of IMI products in pulses, and for those growers growing clearfield canola, of course, there are certain IMIs within clearfield canola, or perhaps clearfield sunflower, perhaps, where there's, you know, more issue. So you're going to have to understand which products have that greater risk for carryover. If you're considering durum, perhaps going to spring wheat might be a slightly safer choice. I know producers will tell me they don't cut corners, but we'll just say, do your best not to cut corners under those types of situations. That's just gonna increase the risk in those situations.
So then if we have, you know, if you have a field and you've kind of gone over the history and you're concerned that herbicide residuals might be an issue coming into this season, what are your options as a producer?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. In some cases, I think a producer is going to have to evaluate what their level of risk or comfort with risk is and make a cropping decision based on that comfort level of risk. That may mean switching out of the crop type. It may mean switching within a crop type, such as the example I just gave with going from durum to spring wheat. If barley is less sensitive, perhaps it's going from spring or durum wheat into barley, perhaps. So it's really a matter of A, understanding the risk, which means understanding your fields, understanding the products that have been applied, what the conditions are like, and then evaluating your level of risk and you know, adjusting accordingly.
So are there tests that you can run?
At this time of year, well, I'll say at any time of year, the best test, which unfortunately is the least convenient and perhaps least practical, is a field bioassay. And basically what that means is planting in a planter's or air seeder's width of the crop to be seeded next year, plant it across the entire field, and let it grow till I'd say at least the sixth leaf stage, perhaps longer, just to evaluate what happens. Unfortunately, that is not very practical for most producers, but it is the most accurate and frankly is the way that herbicide companies develop their guidelines for recropping. There are some labs that will do a chemical extraction, whereby they will test for the specific active ingredient. Now you need to supply them with that active ingredient. You can't go out there and guess. You need to ask for a specific active ingredient. And they will come back and they'll tell you there's X number of parts per million of that active in the soil. Hopefully that they say it's zero, but if there are, you know, let's say 10 parts per million active X left in the soil, the challenge is that the herbicide manufacturers can't correlate what that 10 ppm will be in most situations. The other issue with doing that becomes sampling. If you make any kind of sampling errors by combining too much soil from an area that's at very low risk of carryover, that's going to skew the results. There can be errors at the lab in terms of sampling. I've had some results come back where you work it backwards to an application rate. And I had one result come back a number of years ago where the application rate was four times what the labeled rate would be based on ppm per acre. So I'm not a real fan of those diagnostic tools. They don't give me a lot of confidence being able to tell a producer, you know, what they can safely seed. And of course, after speaking here in late April, that doesn't give a producer very much time to sample right now and to evaluate. So again, the field bioassay is going to be the most accurate. I would suggest if a grower is in this situation after a dry year, let's say it's August, and they're concerned about it having been a dry year, and they're looking forward to the following year, then an option might be to do a pot bioassay, where you accurately sample a fairly large number of places in the field. And what I'd suggest doing there is to sample mid-slope, tops of knolls, and low spots, and perhaps combine those low spots all together and the mid-slope all together, etc. But you know, the more samples you can create, the better. And then place your sensitive crop or choice of crops. Maybe you want to have a selection of crops in those pots and try and do everything, you know, similar to what you do in a field situation. And that will give you a second best guidance, I would suggest. You can do that in the winter as well. But of course, you know, the window in the middle of February doesn't produce light like it does out in the field. So it's a little bit more difficult to evaluate, but I think it's probably a bit better method than the chemical extraction and certainly more convenient than a field bioassay.
So aside from the SASC Ministries herbicide carryover maps and the crop protection guide, what other resources would you recommend to producers to look into if they're concerned about herbicide carryover?
There's a number of really good resources. I've not found one yet that serves every single purpose, unfortunately. Maybe there's an opportunity for a retired agronomist, but certainly the SASC Guide to Crop Protection, page 83 of the 2021 edition, has got some information as to sampling and as to what carryover potentially could look like. The Crop Protection Lab in Regina can be a resource, but I really want to emphasize you really need to provide as much detailed information as you can. You really want to give them fresh samples. If you live close to Regina, fantastic. Drive them down to the lab yourself the day you took them out of the field, but don't leave them on the dashboard of the truck. Really well-preserved fresh plants are really helpful for them to make an evaluation, as well as lots of detailed descriptions. There are a number of books that are available. There was one that was published in 1986, so it's getting pretty dated now. And I'm not sure that it's still available, but it's a book that was published by Alberta Agriculture. Yarish and Sharma were the authors. And the book's called Recognizing Herbicide Action and Injury. I looked this morning on the Alberta website, couldn't find it there any longer, but perhaps there might be some kicking around on Amazon, you never know. There's another one published by Alberta Ag from 1996 called How Herbicides Work. So people will probably be a little familiar with Linda Hall, Hugh Becky, and Tom Wolf. They collaborated to write that book. It is available on the Alberta Ag website for $35. It's a pretty good book for understanding how herbicides work, as the name implies. The North Dakota State University Weed Control Guide is excellent. Don't expect pictures, but very good text and textural description. And that's my preference, frankly, is the textural description over pictures. There's another one from the Canadian Weed Science Society called Soil Residual Herbicides, Science and Management. This is not one for the not technically inclined. So if you don't love science, this is not for you. But if you're an agronomist, I would consider it a go-to book. Hopefully it's still available from CWSS. It was published in 2005. And there are some photos available from the College of Ag and Bioresources that Rick Holm put together a number of years ago. If you like, Kaylee, I can send you the links if you have an ability to put them up.
Yeah, that would be great. We can link them at the end of the podcast. We'll put them in the description for people to check out.
For sure. And lastly, I really, really want to emphasize, please don't fall into the trap of just taking pictures and saying, you know, sending it out by text or Twitter and saying, what's this? There's not a lot of value at that, and you get a lot of wags, wild ass guesses. So you really, you know, the more description and the better you can describe. For example, rather than saying the plant's yellow, let's say it's the third and fourth leaf that are yellow on the leaf tips and the leaf margins. That's far, far better and can help to lead to a much more accurate diagnosis.
Perfect. Well, I think that's all I had prepared for today. So if there's anything else you want to add, you feel free to do so.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, make use of the resources that are out there. There are some excellent agronomists, excellent crop consultants, some of the crop extension specialists with SaskAg love to do that type of thing. So make use of them, whether it's in person, which, you know, maybe is a little bit difficult in a COVID environment these days, but certainly over the phone, make use of them. They can help steer you in the right direction.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you, Haley. You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to Wheat Profit, brought to you by the Saskatchewan Wheat Development Commission. For more information on wheat agronomy, marketing, advocacy, and research, please go to saskwheat.ca or follow us on Twitter, where we are @saskwheat.